I'm sure we've all gone through times where our kids just simply do not sit still, where they wriggle around, where they get up, move around, and no matter how much redirecting, it's almost impossible to help them or guide them to sit in one spot and do one thing. And I know this carries over to school as well. It's common for kids to be fidgety, to not pay attention, to have difficulties sometimes with their concentration, for something to go in one ear and come out the other. And it's hard sometimes for them to control these actions. When these troubles get in the way of everyday life, one possible cause might be attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. This is a medical condition where children have trouble focusing, where they can't sit still a lot of the time and they act before they think. This behaviour can become big, a really strong emotion, a really big behaviour and extreme impact on their day-to-day lives. More information about ADHD can be found at the raisingchildren.net.au, searching for ADHD. This is a really good website or resource for most kids' health topics that I'll be presenting in this podcast series. Dr. Colin Derrick is a paediatrician who specialises in ADHD. He works out of the Perth Children's Hospital and in private practice, and he sees a wide range of ages in this field. I was lucky enough to spend some time talking to him about this topic and ask him some questions to find out more and to get a real understanding of how this condition might present.
Raising children can be one of the most challenging life journeys you will ever take. This is the Kids Health Network podcast, supporting happy, healthy children and demystifying common medical and psychological problems with experienced health professionals. Hosted by father of two and general practitioner, Dr. Andrew Leach.
Okay, so I'm really lucky to be joined by Dr. Colin Derrick here, who has a strong special interest in ADHD. He's also a general paediatrician, and I have joined him here at his clinic after he's had a busy day. So thank you for giving up your time.
You're
today,
welcome. It's
Colin.
A pleasure.
I'm fascinated by ADHD. It seems to be something I see regularly, mainly because parents have concerns about this condition. I was wondering if you could start off by telling us a little bit more about what ADHD is.
Yes.
I guess that's a good starting point. And maybe some of the signs that parents could be looking out for in their children.
Yes.
If they had a concern. So take it away. It's a big open question.
Yes, ADHD is a very interesting topic to talk about. And it's a very rewarding topic or a condition to treat. Now, I wouldn't call it a disease. I'd call it more a condition. And there's been a lot of focus about all the negative things, which I'll highlight, but there are actually a lot of positive things about having ADHD. ADHD stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And there are four main pillars of the diagnosis, which are there in children. Not all of them have all of them, but the mixed type or the most common type that we see has hyperactivity, poor concentration, easy distractibility, and poor impulse control. Now, it has to be at an age appropriate level. So it's normal for a three-year-old to run around, charge around, not be able to not say inappropriate things like, "Mummy, why is that lady so fat?" for example. Mm. It's normal for three-year-olds to be impulsive, distractible, but it's not that normal for a six-year-old child. And if there's a big difference in the activity or the ability of a child to function when he's six, then you have to compare him to the other children. So if he's the only child who can't sit still on the mat, can't work for more than 2 minutes, can't get stuff done, and is very distractible and impulsive, then you've got to start going, wow, does this child have a problem that we need to address? Okay. Mm-hmm. We do see the severe children with ADHD come a lot earlier than the mild to moderate ones. So the severe kids with ADHD really, really battle right at kindy, pre-primary, year one. They battle to engage academically. They battle to not be disruptive. They're very difficult for the teachers to look after. And they're not just naughty children. And I don't even like the word naughty children, because children learn behavior. ADHD comes as a mixed type where all of those features are present. Those are hyperactive, impulsive children who are charging around in the shops, can't wait in the queue, are blurting out, running around in the shopping center, can't stand sitting still in the car or sit still at meal times, or the kids in the movies that run up and down between the aisles that drive the parents mad. They're also kids who battle socially. They're impulsive, they poke the other kids, they fiddle with them, they can't stand still in the line, and they don't have many friends. They're socially isolated because the other children are afraid of them because they're unpredictable. They call out, they say things, they throw things, they'll hit out in an impulsive way that the child then regrets and is full of remorse. I've seen a child slap his sister and almost start crying while he was doing the slapping, going, well, he knew it was wrong, but he couldn't stop himself. The inability to concentrate and focus is the big thing. They can't engage with the academic process, and children with severe ADHD can't progress at school. Now, sometimes you get an inattentive subtype, which is much less common, and more common in the girls that just sit in the back of the class daydreaming in their own world, wondering what's going on the weekend. And because they're not disruptive in the class, and because they're not behaviorally disturbed to the extent that the other kids are, that they tend to just go unnoticed. And in year five, they can't really write their name, and everyone goes, gee, what happened? We better help. Mm-hmm. So ADHD comes in a spectrum. And it's difficult clinically to diagnose because it's not like pneumonia where you can do a chest x-ray and a blood test, or a brain tumor where you can do an MRI scan. A lot of us have these features in normal life. So normal people get depressed some days. Normal people get anxious some days. It doesn't mean that they've got bipolar mood disorder. So some people do have days where they don't focus and concentrate. It doesn't mean that they've got ADHD.
That's the difficult thing, is because lots of kids are busy. And parents come in because they're worried, is this normal busyness of a child? Is this a normal cheeky child? Or is this something else? And I guess what you're saying is, when it's impacting on their school or their life.
And their functioning.
That's when we start to look and take interest in that.
And if you've got a child who's not progressing academically, who's not making friends, whose self-esteem is starting to drop down, so they're starting to realize that they're a bit different to other children, that's when you need to interact, or intervene rather, because if the child starts believing that there's something wrong, or that they're stupid or not smart, then it's much harder to help them. Yes, so now I just wanted to make sure that you realize that not all children with ADHD need medication, and not all children with ADHD symptoms actually have ADHD. You have to spend a lot of time with the family, which is what makes it a lengthy, difficult process. A lot of children don't sleep properly because they're having nightmares. A lot of children have allergies. They've got obstructive sleep apnea. They're tired at school, so they don't concentrate. You know what a child is like if they don't sleep. They get hyperactive, most of them.
That was actually going to be a key question. Is there an impact of sleep on children and their behaviour?
Huge impact.
And I think something I've been looking out for, and sort of a standard question now, is how is the child sleeping? Because I think that's a really important area. And it can be a medical cause, so there could be a medical underlying problem going on. And we need to look for that, you know, obstructive sleep disorder or something like that, or restless legs, or even a deficiency in a nutrient.
Iron deficiency is a big one.
So I guess there's other secondary things that need to be explored. And I was very interested to hear what you thought about sleep in general.
Sleep is a huge impact on everyone's health and everyone's life. We know that even old people get presenile dementia much more if they don't sleep properly, because their brain doesn't purge the proteins that accumulate, doesn't do the natural pruning of the dendritic interactions of cells. Sleep is very important for growth as well. Sleep is when you package everything and sort out what you need to keep, what you don't need to keep, and your brain has a chance to rest and restore itself to health. That's the whole point of sleeping. Children that don't sleep properly sometimes is because they're anxious, sometimes because they've got a physical thing like an allergy, and they've got obstructive sleep apnea or large tonsils and adenoids, and they snore and wake up all the time. Sometimes they've got bad sleep training. Sometimes they've been sleeping with their siblings or sleeping with a parent who snores, so they wake up all the time. Sometimes they wet the bed. Sometimes they've got a medical condition that's making them wee a lot in the night, up all night peeing, and there might be a problem with that. So sleep really is important. But the biggest thing we see with sleep is the preteens and the teens who are on their devices SMSing people, Facebooking at night, gives them a bit of a serotonin burst when they get that happy feeling of someone liking their comment. We all have that. It's just much worse in children because they're vulnerable. They need to feel accepted. Their self-confidence needs to be established, as older people can handle it more if no one likes their comment on Facebook. But if they're all on their devices at 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning waiting for someone to like their post, well, they're not going to manage at school the next day.
Probably more than what we hear about, or more than what they're willing to admit anyway.
Even in my own children who sneak the iPad under the gown or put it under the doona so they think we can't see. But it's a huge fight that everyone talks about.
Yes.
Taking devices away from kids so they can sleep.
Yes, I think it's really important advice, actually. Easier said than done, but important. On the flip side, do children with ADHD have a poorer sleep, because they're
so restless.
Do they get restless?
Battle to fall asleep. And the severe ADHD kids, you sit and talk to them to get the history of what they were like when they were small babes. They were usually the colicky, miserable, cry baby that was up every hour at night and no one could settle them. They're often kids that take an hour or 2 hours to fall asleep, and the parents want to tear their hair out because they've been running around after the kid all day, trying to do their work, trying to sort everything out, and it's 10 o'clock and they want some quality time with their partner or downtime, and the kid's awake and the kid's in their bed and the kid can't go to sleep, and the kid comes and tells you about an assignment they forgot about or has a question about where they're going on the next holiday. And it can be very trying.
So does that require sleep training or medication, both, or a combination?
Definitely both. Yeah. No therapy for ADHD is in isolation. You have to look at the whole thing, and each person is different. It's not like child's got pneumonia, give him antibiotics. One therapy for all. I'm simplifying it, obviously. But it's really a matter of figuring out which is the important part to treat. Some children watch horror movies at 5, 6, 7 o'clock. Maybe mum's cooking and doesn't watch them. And then they can't sleep because they're scared. I've had kids that I said, well, what were you watching? Oh, the one was watching Lord of the Rings. I can't watch it because it makes me too scared to sleep. Imagine what a 7-year-old is going to think trying to watch that. So that's sleep. But there are lots of other things that mimic ADHD as well, I'm sure you're about to ask.
Yes. I'm just wanted to flip over to diet as well, and then we'll come on to the other things. So with diet, do you find that's also a really important area to explore?
Huge area. I drive up the road from Byford on the way to work, and they've stopped selling them at 7-Eleven, but I used to see 15 to 20 teenagers with a litre of Fanta slushy in the morning. You give that to any kid, they're not going to sit still at school then. You feel sorry for the teacher. Children need healthy, balanced diet. It's a very important part of ADHD treatment. They don't manage if they drink Coca-Cola. It makes them worse. And those things are unhealthy. Not that you can never have lollies. Saturday afternoon party, yeah, have some lollies, even some fizzy drink. But generally speaking, it's not everyday life. Unfortunately, we live in a society where junk food is very cheap and where children are very demanding. And parents find it too hard to say no. And sometimes it's hard to be the boss of the child when the child's going on and he wants a slushy from McDonald's instead of healthy food. It needs to be a treat on the weekend. It's not good for children's brains.
When we actually reflect on that with parents, I'll ask them a bit about what they've been eating, and it's very interesting to hear the behavior immediately after having some junk food or having something sweet. The child tends to be a little bit more active and busy and
I'd say
difficult
a lot
to control.
Mostly it's a lot.
So it is amazing the impact of food and diet. And I've also noticed a lot of parents struggle to get that breakfast in the morning, and I'm sort of say, well, how's the concentration if they're not eating breakfast? How
exactly
do they cope in the day?
Or if they eat a bowl of Fruit Loops.
Yes, yes.
Or Cocoa Pops.
A lot of hidden sugar out there, but as a parent myself, I know how hard it is to say no. It can be very tricky.
Absolutely.
And kids are sneaky, so it's not an easy thing. You open up a really important question there about what else can mimic ADHD. And I think we've talked a little bit about how various medical conditions can be sort of hidden in the background and need to be looked at as well along the way. So it's not always clear cut. But do you see other comorbid or coexisting conditions that sort of are very similar to ADHD or other alternative diagnoses that can be very similar and difficult to...
Yes, and it's difficult to tease it out, which is why it takes effort and time and it's a lot of energy talking to people.
It is. The history is very powerful.
And the observation from other people, not just the parents, from the school teachers, is important to get. And we do live in a society where people think that doctors are like Star Trek. What's the guy's name? Dr. Bones.
Yes.
He had a bitty buzzy thing that said, oh, this is too high, this is too low, fix it like that. So I've actually had people drop off their kids for an ADHD assessment with just the kid. And I'm kind of going, no, this is all about seeing how functional the child is. How is he relating with his friends? How is he managing in the class? It's all a lot of... difficult discussions that it takes a lot of time, and a lot of people aren't willing to do that work. It's always bad if any doctor says after 2 minutes of talking to the person, he has some medication. That's really bad. Sometimes I speak an hour to the patient and I'm not sure. So the conditions that can mimic it, yes, are anxiety, depression, bullying, family trauma, a family that's chaotic and not in one house for very long, or not at one school for very long, or if the child's being bullied, all of those things come into play. Autism can sometimes go with ADHD. You sometimes get them together, but we see straightforward ADHD as the small majority. The majority of children with ADHD have comorbid problems, especially if you leave it longer and longer and longer. They have learning problems, they have occupational therapy problems, they have sensory processing problems, they might have hearing problems, they might have visual problems. But going back to the psychological things, it's oppositional defiant disorder. And you do feel sorry for these kids. They're usually smart, compliant kids, but over time they get moaned at and groaned at so much that they start feeling that they can't please anyone. So they think, I might as well do something bad if I'm going to get in trouble for being bad all the time. And that's when the trouble starts, and then they can go on and be conduct disordered and disengage with the academic situation at school. They get a bad reputation, and you know what it's like to have a bad reputation in school. Once you have one, it's very difficult to come back from. And your heart goes out to those kids because they were not bad kids to start with. They just got tired of being moaned at all the time. So self-esteem is very important for parents to look after. But I think I've got off the topic of your question.
Well, I think also what you're saying is that diagnosis early is really important. Not always possible, again, because it can be a bit hidden in amongst other things, but trying to get the clarity around it as early as possible before it does get harder and harder as school years go on. And when do you classically diagnose this condition? Is there a certain age group that you would say that's when it's most obvious? Or, like you said before, can you start to see early signs in the kinder years and earlier on than that? Is it something you can...
You definitely get a flavour of it in kindy for the severe ones, kindy pre-primary. Most of those I would not start on treatment. The guidelines are to start medication at 6 years of age, but you can do a lot of other things before you start medication. Occasionally there are children that just cannot go to school unless they have medication. If you've spent a lot of time fixing the other things, like diet, like sleep, like anxiety, looking at all of those things, and they're still not coping. Some of them do, but that's the vast minority. Then the average kid with moderately severe ADHD would get medication in year one and year two. The milder kids can make it through high school. A lot of them are very smart. Sorry, not through high school, through primary school. They're pretty smart kids and they can wing it. But when they have to take in the volume is when they usually fall apart. Year seven, year eight, year nine. So I know if I get a referral for a year nine kid who's been doing fine and is now battling, I kind of go, well, he's not a severe ADHD. He might need medication, but he's managed thus far.
Something else might be going on.
And you get people that go through university and later on in life realize that they do have significant concentration problems.
Well, I'm now getting adults come in sort of, now that they were more aware of ADHD, adults come in thinking that's what's been going on throughout their life. They've always struggled through school or university, and they are seeking that clarity on that diagnosis.
And so sometimes it's a relief to actually go, I do fit into this category and maybe I would have benefited from some help. And it's never too late. A psychiatrist who look after adults sometimes even put
fairly elderly people on medication. And these people battle. They battle to maintain relationships. They battle to manage their budget. They battle to manage their emotions. High incidence of depression, anxiety, comorbid with it. They battle to hold down a job. All of those things are pretty important things in life. Mm. And if you look back, they've often battled. And if you look into the family, there's a strong heritability. There's often a family history. Oh, my dad was never good at school. My uncle's never good at school.
So is it a genetic condition?
Yes, there's a very strong underlying genetic flavor to it. Or there's no specific gene that's been identified yet, but we do see it running in families very strongly.
It's very interesting, yeah. So if a parent brings their child into you, do you make the diagnosis on the history and the examination, or are there screening tools that you use in practice?
There are lots of things that we gather, and often by the time the child has come to us, they've seen an occupational therapist, they've seen a psychologist, they've got school reports, they've had some intellectual assessments. I tend to prefer to see children once they've done a couple of those other things, because it does give us a lot of good information. School teachers, of course, spend a lot of time with the kid and they get to know the kid very well. And if you read the school reports, teachers know how to communicate to doctors, and they put in code words like he is different from the other children because he can't sit on the mat for more than 2 minutes and he needs constant supervision. He needs one-on-one help from an adult to get any work done. So you get clues going through it. So I look at all school reports. I look at the Connors report. Some people look at, it has different names. There's a Vanderbilt score. There's a SNAP questionnaire. There's online ADHD tools. I don't really mind using any of them, but they're all very helpful. And you can work out scores. You can work out probability in terms of percentage likelihood of a child having severe ADHD. All of those tests you can use in an assessment of a child. I think the important thing is that you can never base a diagnosis on one parent's observation in one environment. It needs to be in more than one environment that there's a problem. So, for example, my youngest child has very ADHD behavior at home, but at school he's calm, he's quiet, he does his work, he gets distinctions for everything. He's not socially having issues, but he gets home and he's impulsive and quite cocky and interruptive and very much like ADHD. And I've always gone to the teacher saying, oh, are you sure he's okay? School report's fine, he's fine at school. So you can never just call it in one environment. It needs to be pervasive through the child's life.
I think that some of the more difficult patients is when one area is impacted and then they're perfect in the other area. And it can create a lot of confusion about, what do we do here? Is this child just more relaxed at home and more themselves? Or are they more relaxed at school and more themselves? Which one is it? So that's that's quite a classic case that we would see.
And it sometimes can be quite an art. Sometimes people forget that medicine is an art. Yes, it's a science.
It's not always perfect.
It's not always perfect. And I always say you don't treat a child unless there's a problem academically, a problem socially, a problem with self-esteem, or a real problem with behavior at home.
I guess finishing with treatment, and that's probably one area that people would be really interested in. I am going to speak to an occupational therapist in due course for a podcast about the role of occupational therapy, the role of psychology in this, and it's very important.
Absolutely.
And as you said, it's a whole treatment. It's not just one thing that works in isolation. So do some children just do therapy and do really well with that?
Yes, absolutely. And again, medication needs to be at the back of the shelf. You should never reach for medication first. You need to try. Occupational therapists have got very good strategies that they employ. Psychologists have got good strategies that they employ and can be very helpful. All of the guidelines, both in Australia and internationally, never say medication alone. They all say a combination of therapy. Sometimes it's family therapy, sometimes it's psychotherapy, sometimes it's a nutritionist, occupational therapy, sometimes it's remedial education. All of these things can help and should not. The point is, medicine is not for isolation. And it shouldn't be in the front of your cupboard. You shouldn't reach for that as the first thing. But sadly, we live in a society where we want a quick fix for everything. And these kids take time and they take effort.
Yeah, absolutely. Who would you select for medication? Is there a cutoff, or is there, so you get a feeling that this child has already had some therapy and you know, maybe needs that extra layer of support? Is it really hard to answer that? Is it something?
No, you assess the degree of how much dysfunction there is in the child and in the family. Mm. And some parents have different ways of tolerating it. Some parents don't tolerate it if their children are hyperactive and they get very stressed out and they're calling for medication sooner. Those people should see psychologists or occupational therapists first. I always tell parents, medication is the last step. You don't want to give your child chemicals to treat something unless it's really the last resort. And I do that with my children. They have to have a high temperature before I reach for some Calpol. They really must be moaning about the headache before I give them Nurofen. Because you shouldn't reach for medicine as a first line for things. I prefer for people to come and see me when they've seen a psychologist, when they've had some therapy, when they've seen an OT, when they've sorted out the diet. And a lot of people know that about me, so they will even go and see a naturopath or a homeopath, and then they'll come and say, well, we're not responding. The child's really needs help. And I'll go, right. The decision to treat a patient with psychostimulant therapy or alternative treatments in medical parlance that we have is not just the doctor's decision. It's a combination of the doctor, the parent, and sometimes even the child. Mm-hmm. If you've got a 12-year-old, if he doesn't believe he's got anything wrong and he refuses to take medication, he needs to be involved in the process so that you can get him on your side or on the side to help him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that team approach is perfect. When you get to the medication, is there a particular type? Like, it sounds like the amphetamine based medication works really well with ADHD.
Yes.
Just for the general understanding of the audience here, what does that actually do? Because I thought that was a stimulant. So,
yes. Yeah.
Why do we want to stimulate kids' brains more with medication that is a stimulant? You'll be better at explaining.
So it works on the prefrontal cortex. It works on the drugs we use work on dopamine and adrenergic receptors to increase those levels in synaptic areas in the brain. They are stimulant medications, a bit like coffee. But what happens, it stimulates the area that helps to slow your brain down. So you're stimulating the part of the brain which helps you to calm down rather than just wind it up all the time. So it's a bit counterintuitive, and I don't even like the word stimulant. We use stimulants as first-line treatment for ADHD. They work. We've got two main ones, methamphetamine, that's completely wrong, dexamphetamine, and methylphenidate, right? If you use one of them, you've got 80% chance of good therapeutic response. If you don't have a great response, you can switch to the other, and the vast studies that have been done, and there's huge amounts of studies that have been done, you can get 85% control of the core symptoms of ADHD. If they're not tolerated for side effects or they're not working as well as they should, then you can switch to second line therapy, which is the non-stimulant based medication like Strattera or guanfacine or cadaprase.
Okay, and we were talking just before this podcast about stopping children off medication. I mean, it's probably really good to know that it's probably not lifelong that they have to stay on this. Yeah. So there are times and opportunities throughout their development in school where things become more settled and they have a chance to maybe have a break from the medication. And I've certainly got patients that don't use it in school holidays and they get a break then as well. But like you said, for the right child, it makes a huge difference treating them, medication or not, but actually just getting the right sort of answer and treatment. It's so rewarding.
It is very rewarding. Now, just on that weaning off medication, you should always have an exit strategy, and that's something you talk to the parents about right at the start. If the child does well and he settles down well, I usually say, okay, well, let's give it some time and then we'll try and stop it. But it's interesting what parents tell you. Some parents will tell you, there's no way I'm going through a school holiday with this child off medication because they'll break the house down and it's unsafe for the child. And there's some that say, the kid is fine at home, he just really needs it for school so that he doesn't need it on the school holidays. So what the parent tells you must guide you. I like them to start a new school year, get to know the teacher, get to the end of the first term, have the school holiday, take the medication away, let them go back in second term, the teacher knows them, they know the teacher, see what happens.
Okay.
And the kids that really need their medication, they'll be calling you for another script because they really need it, and everyone can tell.
Yeah, well, it makes a huge difference.
So there is a group of people that need it as they go forward. I'll quote you about probably less than 30%.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Okay. Well, how many children are on medication in Australia?
Okay. Well, I can give you numbers for Western Australia. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, Western Australia.
The incidence of ADHD, whether you're Japanese or from Iceland or from the Congo, is between 2% and 4%. Okay.
Okay.
Right. We in Western Australia had about 1.5% of the children on stimulant medication. Okay. Which is about right, because you only really need to treat half the kids that have got ADHD on medication. The others you can help with diet, psychotherapy, those other things which can be very powerful and can help you not get onto medication. But there are other societies in the world, some of them in the Northern Hemisphere and some that have many states, and some of them have got 11% of their children on psychostimulant medication. That is crazy, and it sends such a wrong message, because they're trying to alter their children cosmetically, and that's such a wrong message to give to your child. Well, I'll love you more if you get a distinction in maths.
Yeah, or it's massive variation, isn't it?
And that's wrong. You treat with medication when there's a problem.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting to hear about what could be causing that, but maybe that will leave that for another day.
Absolutely. That's a whole minefield.
If you were to give any resources to patients, do you know any really, really good resources online that are, you know, quite evidence-based, or is it I try and avoid getting patients to Google, because they end up in a minefield of information. Some is good, some is incorrect. And
I'm very careful what I tell people. There's a couple of books I usually refer people to, and I'm not going to put them out here because I don't want anyone to think I have a commercial interest in them, because I don't.
Yes.
But what I would tell people is, if you're going to Google and go on a website, go on a university site that has a medical school with scientific backup. There are a lot of websites. Anyone can create a website. I could create a website on how to be a plumber, but I'm not a plumber. I could write the biggest lot of nonsense and just say I'm a plumber, but you wouldn't believe me, would you?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah, I think you just have to be really careful where you're getting information from and make sure it's reliable and reputable resource. Look, in summary, what would you say is a good take-home message for this?
Take-home message for ADHD: it's a very real condition. It can be treated. It's a very rewarding condition to treat. It's hard work to treat it. It takes a lot of hours, and it's not a simple, here's the diagnosis, here's the treatment, go away, and here's a script for 20 years. It's a regular evaluation, monitoring the weight and height, the blood pressure, monitoring how the child's going. It is hard work, but very rewarding. Yes, the condition is probably overplayed in the media. Yes, there are some vilifications. Some people prescribe it for conditions that they shouldn't and give it out to children too much. But you need to realize that some children need it. I had a child that I was not wanting to treat, and the mum phoned me, the kid was 5. She says, he's so hyperactive and impulsive. He set fire to the carpet and he's killed the parrot by turning the parrot's neck. Mm. She said, if you don't give me medication, I'm going to go somewhere else for medication. And I said, yes, okay.
You know there's a turning point.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you so much, Colin. And I think from our perspective in GP, supporting the parents as well, as you say, it takes so much time. So much effort from everyone, the teachers, the parents, to help rally behind that child and help them through that difficult period. So, you know, really making sure you look after yourself as well as a parent, because you are the people that are heavily invested in this. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, but thank you so much for your time today. It's been really great to hear your opinion and message and expertise about this area, which is a very interesting area and one that we are seeing a lot in our practice. And I think it'd be great. It's great having that summary there of what common things to look for and common treatments that you use. So thank you.
This has been another Kids Health Network podcast. The information and advice provided here is for general purposes only. It is not an alternative to the medical advice offered in person by your GP, paediatrician, or other health professional relating to you or your child's specific condition. If you have concerns that you or your child is acutely unwell, please seek immediate medical attention. For more, find us on Facebook or Instagram at Kids Health Network.